Out. Go Loud presents Magnified with Matt Cooper. Proudly sponsored by Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Move your business forward with a fleet of commercial or passenger vehicles. Build your fleet to your expectations. Visit vwfs.ie/business.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Second up in this new series of Magnified is a man who is very familiar to the audience of The Last Word and Today FM. His Thursday environment spot is one of our most popular items, and we've just had episode 150. It may also be one of our most unpopular parts of the programme, though, judging by the often vitriolic responses we receive by text and by WhatsApp to what he says. But what he's covering is not just important, it is essential. And if it makes people uncomfortable, well, we're just going to have to live with that. But who is John Gibbons? What has made him such an outspoken advocate? And how does he deal with criticism? Let's find out on this latest edition of Magnified, brought to you with support from Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Move your business forward with a fleet of commercial or passenger vehicles. Build your fleet to your expectations. Visit vwfs.ie/business. John Gibbons is an erudite Kilkenny man, where hurling, of course, will be your main sport. You'll understand the cricket reference when I say 150 not out, which is your score at present on The Last Word for your weekly environment spot. We have a lot of fans for it, and we also have a lot of people who it drives them absolutely mad and crazy. How do you deal with that? Because particularly on social media, I notice you get into a few fights.
Yeah, one or two, Matt. I guess it goes to the territory, I suppose. Obviously, my beat has been in and around environment and climate journalism for the last 15 years or so. And maybe a good chunk of that has been spent online. You know, a fairly large Twitter presence and so on. And yeah, that is a little bit of a magnet for contested views, let's say. And I think it's no secret to say that climate change has become the most scientifically contested space. Not by the way, that contest is not between scientists, of course. It's not happening in the halls of science. It's not happening in the peer-reviewed journals. It's happening instead in places like social media, where effectively everybody's a scientist and everybody has a view. So I tend to, I guess, maybe I tend to draw them on me a little bit.
But why do you engage with them?
It's a good question. I suppose, maybe I'm just a glutton for punishment, Matt. Maybe I am. I think I do try. This might sound naive, but I do try, unless proven otherwise, to engage with people. If beyond a certain point, sure, you just either mute them or block them. But up to a point, if I think a person is trying to understand something or make a reasonable point, you know, I don't think that, you know, I'm above criticism or I'm above being answerable. I really don't. But there's a world of difference between engaging with a member of the public who has a legitimate question and simply being buzzed by trolls. And you know a little bit about that too.
I know, but you can be quite confrontational at times in your response, can't you?
Yeah, I just think that's in me. I think there's somewhere inside the man, there's a small dog, right? I think there is a small dog. I wonder what that is. I think I was very short until I was about 16. And I've a feeling that there's a little terrier in there somewhere. And that's the first time I've actually said this in public. So I honestly think I react. Yeah, I do. Maybe not on air in a situation like this. I like to think I'm kind of reasonably practiced and reasonably measured. But yeah, there is a little, a tiny little red button there. That terrier, that underdog, that small guy who wants to push back against being bullied.
Scrappy Gibbons.
Scrappy Gibbons. Yeah, there is a little bit of that. And as I said, I was barely broke 5 foot heading into Leaving Cert year. That was no fun, you know.
Tell me a little bit about that. I didn't know that.
Just the luck of the draw, Matt. I just happened to be, you know, a small kid in a boarding school, which is tough enough.
What school was that? St. Kieran's?
No, Rockwell, down in Tipperary. So I was over there as a boarder. An interesting experience, let's say. I, as the man says, 5 years without remission. And, you know, it wasn't a fantastic experience, but the rugby was good. That was my main interest. That kind of dragged me through. And again, to be small, playing your bit of rugby, you had to be scrappy. right?
You're in scrum half, were you?
No, I was full back. Yeah, and my the one thing I could do, whatever it was, whatever big bugger it was, I would tackle anything that ran at me. And because I was so small and skinny, they invariably ran straight at me. It's the strangest thing. You'd have these great big guys, big hairy 16-year-olds.
You were a target.
I was considered a target. And as I said, maybe it was my training, catching sheep and things back in the family farm. But I would tackle anything that ran straight at me. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the family farm. And I think this is important. And I want to talk to you about this a little bit because the farmers who listen to The Last Word in particular get very exercised by your comments. So tell us about your farming background and your involvement on the farm.
Yeah, I mean, it goes way back. I suppose, my father, for example, was one of the kind of founding members of the then NFA back in the 50s.
National Farmers Association,
which morphed into the IFA later. In fact, he was one of the nine farmers that sat on the steps of the Department of Agriculture for 21 days. Days and nights in October 66. This is the sort of the so-called NFA, Matt, they call it the nine frozen arses, right? And he was one of those. So basically,
so he was scrappy too. Did you inherit it from him, did you?
Do you know something? Yes, he was. And he was a guy who basically, he had a line. And if you cross that line, you're in trouble, right? And yeah, I think I have a little bit of that. I probably do. So that's the background. I'm one of 12. I'm actually 10, the difficult 10th child of 12. So a large traditional Irish.
What's the age span?
My eldest sister unfortunately passed away 3 years ago. She would have been 69, and my youngest brother now is 51. So we're kind of in the middle. I turned 60 last August, so still a little bit surprised about that. I thought I turned 40 last August, but I checked the calendar, and lo and behold, I turned 60 last August. But you know what, Matt? It'll happen to you if you're not careful.
I'm only a few years away from it. But tell us about the size of the farm and the work you were expected to do as children on the farm.
Yeah, I suppose it was in two parts, really. We grew up on I guess, the family farm, which would have been my father and my grandfather's farm. And we moved from there when I was about 8 or 9. And that was your kind of, chickens in the haggard and a cow for milking in the yard. And very traditional, almost like your picture book farmyard situation, right? And a relatively small farm. But then my father had bought a much larger farm. He'd bought it a number of years earlier, but people who lived there, he waited until they had passed away before we actually moved to that farm. So we moved there in 72, and that was a much bigger operation. And he was...
What type of farming?
Arable. So we basically, lots of beef cattle, no dairy, none at all. He was never a dairy man. I think he found dairy too tying. This idea,
having to milk in the morning, milk in the evening.
Yeah, twice a day, 7 days a week. It's tough. And I'd say that for anyone who does it, it's a tough thing. And it's also, I think it was arable. So we basically did a bit of everything. We had lots of cereals. We had beef, or not beef, sorry. We had wheat, we had barley. I said lots of beef cattle. So we would have brought in, young cattle, fatten them up, sold them on. And that kind of, yeah, so it was a mixed system, and also my father would have rotated around. So, for example, I remember seeing a map. I came across it recently, actually, a map of the farm where he'd broken down, he'd developed rotational plans, so an annual and four-year plans to rotate around. And anyone who knows a little bit about farming will know the idea there was to rest the land, that if you did too much of the one thing on one field over for an extended period, first of all, you get more disease, and second of all, you can actually wear it out. So you do these four-year rotational plans. He'd have been what you call a progressive farmer, Matt. He, for example, he removed many miles of hedgerows, right? One that comes to mind, there was one field, it's quite a big field, probably about 40 acres, single field, and it's called the Big Seven, and you'll probably guess why. When we arrived there, it was seven fields. So he was what I called a progressive farmer. He was interested in bigger machines, doing things on a bigger scale, and he would have been very much teeing up, as it was, say, from 73 onwards, where farming was becoming much more mechanised, and also production as we moved into the EEC. That was increasing and so on. So he would have been one of those kind of vanguard farmers who was very much into production and productivity. And that was the kind of farm that I grew up on. But very much always the idea was that there was a mix. We did different things. So we also had sheep, by the way. We had lots of sheep. So that meant, they kept you busy in the winter. The dumbest animal you'll ever encounter. The animals capable of injuring themselves and putting themselves in harm's way. But I suppose, anyway, so sheep, beef cattle, cereals and some root crops.
It must have been prosperous, though, if you could be sent off to boarding school as the 10th of 12 children.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think part of his kind of scaling up was to probably support this large family, to tell you the truth. I imagine so. I think, like a lot of farmers, I think he was sort of asset rich, but probably cash relatively tight. And I think sending people off to boarding school, see, we're in the middle of nowhere, Matt, right? We're like 5 miles from Kilkenny and no bus, no public transport. So that was a scourge, if you like. It was really out of range for us to be coming and going. So throughout primary school, getting to and from home was a real drag. And so I think part of the boarding school thing was just getting you up and away, right? It was sort of like getting people out of the way and maybe creating enough room, enough space, enough beds for everybody to sleep in.
See, the reason I asked you about the farming is that given what you've just described, and also when you talk about the remoteness, I think maybe some of your critics would expect you to be more sympathetic to the farmer and also to a person in rural Ireland who needs a car because they don't have public transport available to them.
Sure. I mean, like, to be where I grew up without a car was miserable. Make no bones about it. In fact, I hadn't even got a bike in my teenage years, I'm sorry to say. The last bike I got for my 8th birthday, a little blue bike. And that little bike, I'm afraid, had to, some of my early and not particularly successful teenage dating experiences involved arriving to a date on a bike with a picture of a bear on the ringer, right? Now, please, no laughing at home. So, we weren't. And the reason I say that is, while you might say it was a prosperous farm, we were not prosperous. Like, there was you're expected to work. And work you did. But in terms of there wasn't much money knocking around. Like, the kids were not, we weren't given pocket money, for example.
How many acres did you have?
Over 500.
That's a big farm.
That's a big farm, yeah.
And the reason I ask that is because I'm sure you're aware there's been a lot of online comments that when your mother passed and the family was selling the farm, people were asking, oh, why were you selling the farm, blah, blah, as if you weren't one of a big family, as if it was all your own.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I've said I'm one of a dozen beneficiaries of that. And that's life, you know. That's what happens, you know. And
some people were saying you should have rewilded it, but that wasn't in your...
It isn't my decision. No. Like, I mean, like, the everything that has to be done is all laid out legally. So my role in that is negligible.
How long is your father dead?
He died in 89, so he's gone 35 years.
What do you think he would have made of your conversion to environmental issues and your belief in smaller, more subsistence farming?
That's a really interesting question. I'm not sure. We weren't close. I was only 26 when he passed, and we'd had a, you know, difficult relationship. I think most of his boys, it was difficult. It wasn't close. And I'm told by my older siblings that, you know, he got better as you got older, right? And the tension, and because he was an interesting man. He genuinely was an interesting man and a successful man and a very driven man. But I didn't get the benefit of that, if you like. I got the sharp end of that, as just the way he was. And probably if he'd lived another 10 years, I probably would have got to know him as an adult, because certainly I got glimmers of that. And he was a very interesting man. But to answer your question, I think he would have, you know, if we had met as adults, let's say, and I look him in the eye, I think he would have said, OK, I don't agree with you, but I respect that you're clear about why you take this position and that your intentions are honest. That you're not in it, you've no financial gain in it, you're not in it, you're not looking for trouble, you're in it because you believe in what you do and you've done your homework. That would have been very important to my father and my mother.
I was just about to ask you about your mother, because she died only a few years ago. So what does she make of your positions?
Yeah, my mother was enormously supportive of me. That's the first thing I'll say. And she died in January 2022. So it's still relatively...
Only 2 years and a bit
ago. Just a little over 2 years, Matt, yeah. And she was very supportive of me. And I think she found it difficult. She was, for example, she was a paradox. She, on the one hand, was an honorary life member of the IFA. But on the other hand, she was an honorary life member of Antashka, right? So she sort of kicked with both feet, as they say, right? And I think she reflected the paradox that many people in rural Ireland reflect and share. But I think what's happened is when people get into their trenches, then they forget about that side and you only hear about the other side. So this idea that I'm on one side or the other, I've taken a particular position. It's based, I think, on a rational assessment, and I've taken that into the public space, and I know that that has its challenges.
And we'll get back to that in a little while. Yeah. But tell us, what did you do in college after you left Rockwell?
Yeah, I went to UCC and I did English and History. I was very fortunate, Matt. I had a wonderful teacher, you know, in secondary school, an English teacher in fifth and sixth year, a man called Christopher O'Gallagher. And he basically, you know, those kind of sort of, I don't know, eureka moments. And he recognized something in me, an interest, you know, a strong language thing, whatever. And he nurtured me. And that was that lit the light for me. And that inspired me to want to go and like, because up until then I'd been a very middling student. And I went to UCC. And
what years were you there?
81 to 84.
We would have briefly crossed over for 1 year or so.
Okay. Right. I have to say, loved my time in UCC. Wonderful. It was a little unfortunate, I suppose, to have gone from rural Tipperary to UCC, then moved to Dublin directly to do my postgrad in journalism. The result of that is you kind of lost track. And of course, this, Matt, as you know, was in the day long before WhatsApp groups and mobile phones. So hard to hang on to your college friends and even to your school friends, you know. So there was a dislocation between, you know, growing up in primary school in Kilkenny. So I lost track of my primary school kind of gang. Secondary school in Rockwell was very dispersed, then Cork, then back to Dublin. So you kind of, you know, your tribe got a little bit scattered.
You said you went to do the postgraduate diploma in journalism and the NIHE as it was then, which was something that I did in 1987. So you did it in 84.
84, 85.
Why did you decide on journalism?
That's a good question. A friend of mine in UCC told me, I think she got me out of the bed one morning. I was a bit of a late riser, any chance I got. And she got me out of the bed because she said there was this guy called John Horgan was giving a talk down in UCC and I should get my ass down to it. And I went down and he went, I listened to John and I sat there and thinking, I could do that. That sounds really interesting. So that's about the strength of it. I knew I wanted to work with words, with language. Hadn't a clue how that worked. Had no idea, really. So there was no journalism in the family, anything like that. And I thought, yeah, that sounds really interesting. And then, as you know, well, I don't know if it was the same in your time, but in our time, it was a mixture of, you needed, I think, a 2-1 in your primary degree. And then also it was entry by interview.
Yeah, you only needed a 2-2, I know that.
Standards, you know, have slipped.
Standards have slipped. But anyway, yeah.
But so I just remember going out to Glasnevin, and I can't remember the name of the man, but I met this guy and he was my interviewer. Well, sure, we just had the crack. And I remember thinking, God, that was easy. You know, that he mustn't have been interested, because it went so well that I thought he'd obviously struck me off the list and we were just having the crack. And anyway, so, to cut a long story short, I got in and it was a remarkable experience, a remarkable group of people. Only about 20, 21, two of whom, by the way, died within 2 years. Very in tragic circumstances. Both died, one in a road accident that September 85. And another good friend of mine, Helen O'Connor, died tragically. She was drowned off the coast of New York in 87. So to lose 10% of that tiny class in that time scale was amazing. But it was an amazing class.
I know some of the members of that class, some good friends of mine. Marion McKeown, who obviously is a contributor each week in the last word. Lise Hand was also in the class.
That's right. Conor Lenehan was there masquerading as a journalist, but I had the feeling that Connor had something else in mind. but we were very good pals. In fact, we've remained good friends since then. There were lots of good people. I better not start naming people, you know, because then you'll have people saying, well, hang on,
left
you name
me
effectively, you know. But my point anyway was that really for me was the year when the penny dropped, Matt, because it was a group of brilliant people. Because the entry to journalism, as you know, it had only opened at a graduate level, I think, in maybe the year before. And therefore, there was a backlog of people bursting at who'd done degrees. So there were people up, there were old people in that class up to the age of 30. Can you believe it? I had just turned 21. I was the second youngest in the class. The average, the median age, I think, was about 23 or 4, which, by the way, when you've just turned 21, was like being with old people. But the thing about it is that all this experience and all this drive. These weren't your typical college students. These were people who were bursting to get into journalism. It was the life thing. And I suddenly began to go, oh, okay, I get that. And I think it was a very competitive group. I wouldn't have said I was super competitive myself. I think I was I kind of drifted through it. I remember John Horgan bringing me into his office and said, John, have you considered a career in comedy? And I went, okay, I'm not sure this is a compliment, because what he meant is I was a class clown, Matt. I'll admit it, right? And I know this will come as a shock to people who hear me on the radio and think, God, that guy must suck a lemon. He's so serious. I was the class clown, right? Maybe I've been overcompensating for the last 20 years, you know?
What sort of journalism did you do then when you came out of NIHE?
Yeah, after that, I did my placement in Business and Finance magazine.
So did I.
Oh, good, good. I'm sorry for your troubles. Yeah,
but they kept me on for a year afterwards.
Yeah,
anyway.
I have to admit, it was actually a good place to learn,
yeah.
A tough place to learn. And so I did, I think I stayed on for a while, but I left after that. Then a group of us set up an agency, which we named Newsseller. I'm the puns guy, by the way. We were in a basement, so of course we became the Newsseller. And there were various people in that agency, and we basically, I suppose, provided freelance services. At the time, I guess the niche that I cut out at that time was I became an analysis feature writer for the Irish Press. So basically, I was at the end of the John Spain's extension, and he'd ring me up and say, John, do you know anything about X? No. Right, we need 1,000 words about X by 5 o'clock. And I'd be scurrying off into the library. Of course, this again is pre-internet. There was no looking stuff up. You had to find things out. You had to do this other thing, Matt. You had to use the phone. You had to talk to people. I mean, honestly. So that was a fabulous crash course in journalism. And I developed, I suppose, the ability to turn out reasonable copy on a sixpence in record time, and it was something that I was, I suppose, really, really happy to do. I had a little temporary foray into RTE. I must have caught their eye at some stage, and I was invited to test out for Today Tonight, as it was then. And anyway, I made a complete balls of it, to cut a long story short, and was my short test period came to crashed and burned. It wasn't for me. I think, quite frankly, it was too much too soon. I'd had a very good run. I'd had some front page exclusives. I kind of was making waves in 86, but you know, I had a lot of growing up to do at that time. And I just think that for me was a step too far. And I'm kind of, in hindsight, genuinely glad it didn't work out, because the route that I took gave me time to grow up a little bit.
Yeah, the route that you took, though, took you sort of out of journalism for a while, didn't it?
That's right, yeah, because basically, through a long and convoluted story, I continued freelancing, and as I said, I was a very comfortable, very, you know, reasonably well-to-do, and under no pressure in that regard. And also, of course, back in the 80s, you know, rent was cheap. So, you know, you could live in a reasonably okay place. I actually lived in Raglan Road. It wasn't a fancy place, but I was able to walk into town and all the rest. So you could live cheaply and have a pretty good social life on a freelancer's salary, which is probably something that's, you know, much tougher these days.
Near impossible.
Yeah. Anyway, in late 87, I just, through a weird set of circumstances, somebody approached me and said, look, there's a job going as editor of this small weekly medical newspaper called the Irish Medical News. I went, oh, okay. What do you know about medicine? Nothing. What do you know about editing? Just slightly more than nothing, but just very close to nothing. Okay, sounds perfect. Again, met the people, they blagged my way through the interview, and next thing they make an offer. And it included exotic things, Matt, like a car. Hello, this is, you know, 1980s journalism in Dublin. And I kind of said, okay, I'm sure I'll give it a spin. I mean, I'll stick it out for a year or two, make some money. And I love the idea of paid holidays. Basic, really attractive stuff, because I found previously as a freelancer, you go on holidays and you come back really poor, you know, spend money, but there's a big hole in your finances. So the idea of just the regular salary was very attractive. Said I'd give it a spin, and I stuck at that from the end of 87 until early 91. And I guess I learned the ropes a little bit. I guess I learned about editing, certainly learned about production, and learned about the technology side of magazine publishing. And as a weekly newspaper, that was a hamster wheel. You were constantly small staff, constant production. Did it light up my journalistic lights? No, it didn't. But I was learning other skills. And myself and a colleague a journalistic colleague who joined shortly after me. I suppose we kind of put our heads together and thought, you know what, I think we can do this. So in early 91, we had approached an organization called the Irish College of GPs, kind of covertly. Well, I thought it was covertly. And then I found out that my employers knew everything about it because, of course, doctors, they're all gossiping with each other. But I thought I was having these secret talks like an idiot. Anyway, so for some reason, they didn't interfere. So we put a proposal to the Irish College of GPs that we would launch a monthly magazine, full colour A4 magazine for them. And we would write it, edit it and fund it, which was kind of fun because I knew. Remember, I mentioned about how little I knew about medicine and editing. Well, now I was about to plunge into how little I knew about sales and marketing. All right. But of course, so we started off in, we rented a, what would you call it? A townhouse, a two up, two down townhouse in Monkstown. Again, cheap in early 91. And it was super cheap because I lived upstairs, right? And I used to put a flower pot at the bottom of the stairs to stop clients wandering into my boudoir, right? Which did happen one day, by the way. A client came in, moved the flower pot, and next thing she was literally in my, for want of a better word, flat, right? And of course, I was trying to give the impression that we're this, you know, exciting up-and-coming business. But there I was living upstairs on the cheap. But it did the trick. It kept the overheads down long enough for us to get a magazine out in October 91. Then we got another one out in November 91. And by 1992, it just took off. The business just took off. And by the way, I was out selling the ads. So that was another crash course and probably for the first time, really, in also having to, how was there a polite way of putting this, kiss ass. Right. As a journalist, you don't really have to do a lot of that. But I can assure you in sales and marketing, you do tons of it. So I guess, you know, that probably helped, I hope, wipe a lot of the cockiness out of me.
So you became a publisher and developed a business out of that.
That's right. Yeah. So that took us into 92. The business thrived into 93. We had a sort of bit of a setback in 94 because of a drugs budgeting thing that affected advertising. And we kind of got a fright. So we decided we needed to diversify. So we set up a small creative agency. Again, you might ask me, what did I know about that? Nothing, right?
What do you mean by creative agency?
Basically, we'll design your ads. We'll write your copy. So an extension of journalism. We were very lucky. We had taken on the year before a brilliant graphic designer who is still with us, Matt, today. Right. Wonderful, wonderful person and our longest serving employee over 30 years. And that allowed us to develop ideas and I could spin a phrase and write some copy and so on. So we put that together and that basically gave us, if you like, a two-legged stool.
That would fall over.
That would definitely fall over. We'll scrap that analogy. Anyway, it gave us a two-winged operation. That's what I wanted to say. And that gave us a little bit of security of revenue where if the magazines were having a bad time, at this stage, by the way, by the late 90s, we were up to, I don't know, about a half a dozen magazines. We'd sort of set them up and we'd acquire them and so on. We were also publishing with the Nurses and Midwives Organization at that time. And then in the 2000s, we bought out another publisher and took over a few more titles. So it kind of motored along really well. And I'd say at its peak in about 2003 to 2005, I think we just topped out at about 30 people.
Are trade magazines still a thing in the internet era?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're still going. And probably the reason is that the medical and healthcare area is, I suppose, it has been more resistant, if you like, to that. And there's been a longer shelf life and a slower decay rate for publications in that area than there have been in others. Now, we also, of course, in 2000, we set up and launched a website called irishhealth.com, which you might remember because I'm sure, did I speak to you about it? I'm not sure. Anyway, so I spent a few years kind of promoting that. And that, Matt, at one stage, we had 160,000 registered members. We almost sold it to the Irish Times. I think they just exhausted their finances. They paid too much for myhome.ie the year before. And anyway, a long story short, but
You missed out on your chance to become very wealthy, did you?
No, it wouldn't have been. It would have been a very modest seven-figure sale, but not bad for a website, let's say, right? And so anyway, we continued with it. And then basically social media came along and ate all our lunches. So Irish Health, it was a great project. And Fergal Bowers, for example, had worked with me. I hired Fergal in the first place into the medical news. And then when we went to Med Media and we set up Irish Health, I rehired him. As our editor of IrishHealth.com, and of course from there the RT snapped him up, but he was a fantastic front guy in terms of really good media person, but he was with us I think for about 3 years on IrishHealth.com, and that's a website, a health website, you know, with its own professional staff.
So you still have the business?
Yes, yeah. I'm a 50% owner of all the businesses with my business partner Geraldine, and always Matt since day one, and it's one of the most enduring business partnerships probably in Dublin, and the key from always has been nothing gets decided unless we both agree everything.
Is she an environmentalist as well?
Not at all. No, she's a long-suffering business partner, and the way she says it is, she says she reckons the aliens came and took my brain back in the early 2000s. She reckons she knows me for about 35 years, and she reckons I had a head transplant in the early 2000s. She thinks something happened to
me. What did happen?
Oh boy, there's a question. Well, I remember when I met my current wife, as Hugh Leonard used to refer to them. When I met my soon-to-be wife, I remember pulling up in a red 3-litre convertible Toyota Supra. I know. And I was the proverbial boy racer, right? And this is into the late 90s, early, like just coming around the corner into 2000. And, you know, that was the way I saw the world. And I tell you the truth, all this stuff that you and I talk about, if you'd been sitting talking to me here 25 years ago, you wouldn't have heard a word out of me. I knew nothing about it. And I mean absolutely nothing, right? So no background in environmental. And in all the time I'd been in journalism, I'd never written a line about anything environmental. And of course, coming from a farming background, it was simply never on my radar. So something happened, all right, in the early 2000s. And I guess what happened was my eldest girl was born in November 2002. And, you know, I know it's the oldest cliche in the book, but it was a moment. It really was probably the first moment where I kind of thought, you know, I was no longer thinking in sort of, you know, 6 week and 6 month cycles. And I really began to think about further out. And I don't know how it ended up in my hand, but I ended up reading a book written by a historian of science. And it was a history of the biosphere in the 20th century. And it just completely blew my mind. Like so much that I had to put it down and kind of leave it there for a few weeks.
Why? What was in it?
It was, well, all was in it. I mean, in hindsight, I've reread it numerous times since. But in hindsight, simply, it was a tallying of the human impacts on the biosphere from 1900 to 1999. And the guy who wrote it, by the way, there was almost nothing about climate change in it because, you know, in the 20th century, climate change was, it was considered to be what was called an incipient threat. There was something they were aware of, but it simply wasn't on the sort of radar in a really direct sense. It had only really in the very late 80s that it began to sort of register. But essentially, his argument is that our collective footprint on the biosphere has been so extreme in the 20th century. The way he put it was, he said, the 20th century in all of human history, he said that humans converted and used more energy in the 20th century than in all the 19 centuries prior to that in the modern era combined in a single century. So it was almost like lighting a fuse and then bang, this massive explosion of energy, of population, of resources, of water use, of nitrogen, of phosphorus. It was the whole massive acceleration of human impacts. And that, of course, that acceleration went into turbo after the Second World War, where we entered the phase known as the Great Acceleration. And he tracks that out and basically saying, right, we've only got so much biosphere and we're tearing through it. And the phrase that that stuck in my mind always, he said the 20th century was remarkable for all kinds of reasons. He said quite a unique century in human history. And he said it's very difficult to make projections about the future, but the only thing we can say for sure is that there will never be another century anything like the 20th century. And I remember thinking, goodness me. And what he meant is we need to hit the brakes. Plain and simple. And this is like resource depletion, the rising toll of pollution. And this, Matt, was published almost 25 years ago. And you look at all the indices since that book was published. The first quarter century of the 21st century, everything that he warned about, everything that he wrote about. And by the way, this was not a proselytizing exercise. This was a history book, written in that measured tones of a historian. He wasn't a polemicist. He wasn't trying to persuade you. He was just setting out the data.
Okay. We might be bouncing around a little bit now where we go in the next little while, but do you believe in God?
No.
Okay. The reason I ask, were you brought up as a religious person?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. And would you have been observant growing up as the way it was expected of you?
Absolutely, yeah.
I don't know if you would have had a similar experience that I would have had, that you would have had things like retreats, you know, you would have had the Redemptorists would have come to our local church. And I was thinking about this because I remember them as almost fire and brimstone. And you either behave the way we tell you to behave or damnation will be loosened on you. And sometimes I wonder, is there a danger that those who are giving the environmental message at the moment are almost fundamentalist in their approach, in that the way that you talk about what's happening and the way that people need to reform their behaviour is a 21st century equivalent to the way the Redemptorists used to tell us in the 20th century to repent or be damned.
Yeah, I was afraid actually halfway through your intro there, I said, I know where this is going. Oh no. Yeah, look, I understand. And I think it's a fair comment. I suppose I'm not going to lie and say, I mean, I suppose what I've learned and what I've come to understand over the last 20 years, yeah, it has shocked me to my core. And it has also changed me profoundly. I admit that. Maybe the knocked some of the jokes out of me a little bit, probably. Yeah, that's probably true. You're right. I think there is a danger of lecturing and hectoring people. Of course there is. We all have to be careful about that. I hope that it doesn't come across like that too much. But, you know, on the other hand, yeah, we're in the Malagumbi.
But you're conscious and aware of that.
Oh, yeah, danger. Absolutely. And I'll tell you why, I think, because I kind of crashed into national, I kind of reappeared into national journalism, almost like I crashed through the window, right? Head first, landing a weekly column in the Irish Times, which is the sort of the thing out of nowhere, right? And again, probably as much a fluke as anything
else. Yeah, how did you get that?
I'd like to tell you it was through top contacts, but I didn't have any contacts. They were all long gone. No, I just, somebody had mentioned that the Irish Times were on the lookout for somebody, you know, to contribute the odd thing around climate. This was in early 2008. And I remember writing to Peter Murta, as he was then the op-ed editor, and I sent him in some samples of my stuff. And he came back and he said, what I like about your style is, he said, it's not too hectoring. There you go. He said, it's fact-based and it's evidence-based. He said, a lot of the environmental stuff that I get in here, he said, it's all do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that. He said, you're analytical. And he said, that's what we want in the Irish Times. We want analytical. He said, you can tell us what you think of the end, but you got to present your arguments. You got to support it with evidence. He said, yes, this is an opinion piece, but we want evidence. You know, you're not a national personality, right? What we want to know is, you know, before you give us your opinion, you've got to support it with facts. And that's been, I suppose, really, and that particular column, the first one turned into 100. So I was with the Times for 2 years on a weekly basis, every Thursday. And that was a hell of a crash course, because that threw me, as I say, head first and through a window right into the middle of what was also quite a contentious period where, you know, you were running up against all kinds of people. I remember being on your show one day. You had Lord Christopher Monckton on to wind me up. And probably I listened to I have a recording of that somewhere, right? And that's a good few years ago, Matt. And you know, and I know you were yanking my chain and pulling my levers as you do. But I listened back to my tone in that, and it was a little bit strong. I don't talk like that on the radio anymore. I was a bit shouty. I think at the time I was first of all new to broadcast. That wasn't my background, and I was, you know, I had to learn to be a little less shouty and a little more persuasive. And I hope that I've been refining that ever since. But I think some of that early stuff, I was probably very confrontational. I had, for example, a bloodbath of an interview with Pat Kenny on his radio show one morning in November 2009.
And this is when he was
on RT. Yeah, when he was still on RT. And, you know, I mean, the Sunday Tribune and the Irish Times, their radio reviews said that it was, among the most entertaining slot of the week. And I remember...
Not necessarily for the reasons you want.
Well, in fairness, they said, we wonder what did John and Pat shake hands at the end of it? Well, we didn't. In fact, we didn't speak again for over a decade after it.
Yes, but we do.
No, I'm happy to say that, you know, I think I'm sure he was as pissed off about it, by the way, as I was, because I can assure you both of us were fit to be tied. But I was dying off legit going into the studio. I mean, talk about the spider to the fly, right? Going into a studio with the most experienced current affairs broadcaster in Ireland and thinking I could take him on. I mean, honest to God, what an arrogant, I couldn't even say arrogant young fella. I wasn't even young. I hadn't even had that excuse, but I'm afraid I was, what was that thing we said earlier? A bit feisty, a bit of a terrier. And I'd like to think, joking apart, I'd like to think that I've reeled that in and realised that in order to be persuasive, you have to be. I think you've got to keep your emotions in check, and you've also got to just not get into the fight.
Tell us about your credentials, though, because this is something that comes up with your critics on The Last Word. 150 episodes in. And they go, who's this John Gibbons fella to be telling us? He's not a scientist. How can he be actually claiming to have, they know better than us? Put somebody on who'll tell him he's wrong.
Sure. I suppose, again, obviously, I come from precisely the same school as we've just said as you did, which is the school of journalism, where we become, some of us are generalists and some of us are specialists. I happen to be a specialist. So I've focused over the last 20 years on this. I know there's a 2,000-hour rule and there's a 10,000-hour rule. Well, I checked recently. I've exceeded the 10,000 hours on this subject. So, doesn't mean I know it all, but it means I've put in a vast, vast amount of time. I've probably written at this stage somewhere north of 500,000 words that have been published in and around these issues. Does that make me a scientist? Absolutely not. But what it means is I'm able to understand up to a point what the science has been said, and to interpret that on behalf of the public, because that's the role I would see as a specialist journalist, is as we have them, we have health journalists, we have science journalists, we have financial journalists who explain, you know, a financial journalist doesn't have to be a banker. What they need to do is to understand the financial system. So an environmental journalist needs to have their chops. They need to be well briefed, extremely well read, and also to have, I suppose, put in those thousands of hours attending lectures, interviewing experts. And I'm not here to tell you what I think about climate change. I'm here to convey the consensus science position on climate and other environmental issues, Matt.
Consensus is an interesting word, and because an awful lot of listeners say, balance, you need balance, you need 50-50, you need black against white. What's your view on the idea that balance is required?
Sure. Again, as a journalist, that was drilled into us, always hear the other side, etc., etc. I think there's also a more recent phenomenon called bias in balance. And this has been explored, where if you give parity of esteem to the NASA scientist on the one hand and the flat earther on the other hand,
it's a false equivalent.
That's a false equivalent. That's not a debate. For example, the analogy I gave of that interview with Christopher Monckton, right?
Who's Christopher Monckton? I can't even remember. Who
He's a very colourful character. He's a very colourful character indeed. And basically, he's been on the climate denial circuit for years. He speaks like the Queen Mother, he's a very, very extremely entertaining man. He's quite a brilliant mathematician, but like a complete whatever spoofer when it comes
to
this.
Well, I suppose it shows you he hasn't been on The Last Word in many years, and I can't even remember who he is.
But to answer your question, Matt, back when I started, the airways was flooded with balance. I was on numerous interviews. Yeah. I remember being on with George Hook, and he had me balanced up again with hardcore climate deniers, where I'm basically saying...
did he take a side in that?
He was okay, actually, in fair. I mean, you might think that, but I mean, a lot of people gave out about George, but I have to say, I found him okay. But again, you know, that's just me. Sometimes you get along with people better than others. And I, strangely enough, he and I, you know, in whatever number of times I was interviewed by him, it always seemed to be okay. And I always felt that he was sympathetic. And he didn't. And if he started that old nonsense, I was well gone from the studio before he started it.
Tell us about the lifestyle that you lead now, given that you have this knowledge of everything. How has that impacted on where you live, the type of house, what you drive, if you drive, what clothes you wear, how you holiday, all the basic things of your day-to-day life? How have they changed?
Yeah, well, I guess first of all, to go back to your redemptorist analogy, I'm not a monk. I know I'm wearing a black top today, but I'm not a monk. I live among us, as they say. The house I live in now is the house that I've lived in for the last 23 years. The main difference is now it's a kind of Victorian house, but it's now A-rated. So we spent a lot of money getting it up. We did all the insulation stuff a number of years back. Then last year, I think maybe a year before, we did the heat pump part of it. So basically the house is now fully electric.
Is the house suited to that if it's from that age?
Oh yeah, because we invested heavily in insulation, so it's heavily insulated.
How heavily?
Oh, I mean, like nothing weird. You wouldn't notice like a kind of like a cladding on the outside. It all looks very nice, but we just did the full job, Matt, the kind of internal wrap job, and it worked really well. So that's the first thing. I guess we wanted obviously to make it more energy efficient. As you know, I drive an electric car, have done so for the last 6 years, and other than that, I still eat meat. I tend to avoid red meat. I still eat meat, mostly chicken. We're veggie probably 2 or 3 days a week. One of my daughters is fully veggie, completely her own decision. The rest of us aren't. So it's kind of, you know, so I'm not dogmatic about any of these things. I think, you know, we all live in the world. I suppose my focus isn't on saying, gosh, you know, have I told you how pure I am? I'm so amazingly pure. I live this perfect lifestyle. No, I don't. I live a regular lifestyle. But I'm trying to be more conscious of the limits that we operate in.
Has it made relationships difficult for you in the sense you've already said your business partner thinks you were dropped on the head, but she tolerates you? What about your wife and children? How do they deal with not just the fact that you try and live this way, but that you're such an outspoken person in media on it?
Okay. I think probably I never speak on my wife's behalf.
Okay,
no, I won't.
Maybe it's unfair to ask you that.
I think, well, first of all three of them are really supportive. Genuinely. And that's really helpful from my point of view. They're really supportive. Like I kind of got my girls involved, say in the 2019 climate strikes. One of them would have co-written an Irish Times article with me. At least one of them is in studio with you.
Yes.
So they've been kind of marinated in that, which is kind of fair enough, I suppose. It's their parents' interest, so we drag them along. But at the same time, we lay it on very light. And again, they're young people. They've got to live their lives, but they're very aware of the wider emergency. And often, like my 21-year-old would say to me, you know, we understand stuff. It's you old people that haven't a clue what's going on.
Okay, well then maybe to come to an end, and this may not necessarily be an upbeat end to it all, but what future do you think we have? Because, okay, maybe allow me to be slightly pessimistic in that I do get a sense recently that people are getting tired of being told of what needs to be done to save the planet, that they're somewhat disbelieving of the impact of global warming, that they don't particularly want to change their lifestyles, and that it is going to mean that even if the worst doesn't happen, very bad things are going to happen for future generations. Would you fear that, despite what you're trying to do, that we're almost doomed?
I try to avoid the D word, okay? But you're right, because every action, Matt, as you know, provokes a reaction. So climate action, Greta Thunberg, et cetera, that has provoked a backlash in the same way that feminism provoked a backlash. So we're right smack in the middle of that anti-climate backlash right now. It has changed, say, the European Commission, the European Union and so on. We've seen the farmers' backlash against climate action in Europe and so on. So should we be pessimistic about the future? On current trends, we've every reason to be deeply pessimistic about the future. I'm 60. If, you know, assuming that I live a normal lifespan, I believe that I will experience and live long enough to experience many of the direct impacts of this. And people often wonder, well, what do you mean impacts of this? Okay, I think our food system, Matt, in Ireland is hanging by a thread. I could see a situation where we have food shortages, and I don't mean temporary inconveniences, I mean genuine food shortages in Ireland within a decade. I think that's entirely conceivable. I think
explain that a little bit more to me, because I'm sure people would think, well, hold on a second, you're the man who wants us to bring about change in food production, which would reduce our ability to produce so much we need. That this is what all the dairy farmers and the beef farmers say. This is how they make their income. This is how they feed Ireland and feed the world. And you're actually saying that in doing that, they're leaving things hanging by a thread.
Yeah, I'll explain. The reality is almost precisely the opposite of what you've said. Ireland is a net food calorie importer. We import both in foodstuffs, animal feeds and food energy far more than we export. So we're not feeding the world at all. We're exporting some beefsteaks and end products to high-end markets, Matt, in the Middle East and China, the emerging middle classes in Singapore. So we're contributing as a nation nothing to global food security. We're actually taking from global food security by being a net food energy importer. But what bothers me more than that is that the food system, the hyper-specialized food system. We started by talking about my father's farm. That farm was capable of feeding the community. Now, okay, it wasn't like we were bringing it down to the farm gate and handing it out over, but we actually need to start thinking about an agriculture system that is designed to feed human beings. We've got a system that's fantastic at feeding 7 million cattle, but incredibly inefficient at turning primary energy into food calories. Fantastically inefficient. You know, the conversion of primary energy into beef, Matt, is 99% energy loss, 1% energy out the other end. So we've created a food system which is industrialized, commoditized, and very good at producing very little, relatively small quantities with a massive ecological and environmental impact. Now, you might say, well, what else can we do? I mean, very briefly, you take the Dutch, right? Holland is a country about the size of Munster. In Holland, we've got 17 million people living there in a country the size of Munster. And yet Holland, its agricultural system exports about 100 billion euros worth of food. So in other words, about five times bigger than Ireland. And they do that through high technology, particularly horticulture. High technology, they've got, I think it's 35,000 hectares under glass, electronically controlled, sophisticated water management systems, hydroponic agriculture, and they're the world's second largest food exporter after the US. And this is a country the size of Munster. And there's an old joke that says, you know, give the Dutch Ireland and they'd feed the world, give the Irish Holland and they'd drown. Now, it's a horrible thing, but I'm sorry to say that there's a ring of truth about it. We have the lowest percentage of our agriculture in the European Union dedicated to horticulture. Horticulture, by a mile, is the most efficient way, Matt, in a small area of producing food for human needs.
Yeah, but you see, the argument there could be made that what you've outlined is how people are adaptable and how they're able to use technology and scientific advances to overcome climate issues. That, okay, maybe we're a bit behind in Ireland in relation to it, but that even if the population of the globe continues to expand, we'll come up with ways to manage and deal with everything.
Yeah, I know that's a slightly different issue and I wish that were the case, but generally speaking, the problems of technology are rarely solved by adding more technology, right? It's like, you know, you don't put out a fire by adding more fuel to it. And in many cases, some technological advances can be helpful, but what we're seeing over and over again, I'll give you a small example. We've added hugely, as you know, renewable energy over the last decade, particularly the last 4 or 5 years, huge renewable energy. But it hasn't in any way crimped the use of fossil fuels. And the reason, of course, is we've set no global limits. So all we're doing with renewable energy is adding the renewable energy, excuse me, on top of the fossil fuel energy. So without global limits and carbon limits, essentially all our best efforts, including technology, Matt, are in vain.
You see, people then fear that if you put those limits in place, it means standards of living will fall, and they're not prepared to accept that.
And I totally understand that. And my view on this is, you know, the best way I can put this is, and it's a simple analogy, right? Let's say we're on a cruise ship now, right? And that cruise ship, for argument's sakes...
You would never get on a cruise ship when you consider the carbon footprint
this
of
is
the
true.
Construction of
this,
a cruise
this,
ship.
This is true, but let's just say we're on a collective global cruise ship and that ship is heading for the rocks, okay? And we've got two choices. We can get out of the ship and get into the much less luxurious lifeboat, or we can end up in the sea. So at the moment, the choice that we face collectively is a much leaner life ahead in the lifeboat, or basically nothing much at all in the sea. And I mean, that is not, and you'll have to trust me on this, and I'm going to bring all my years of experience to bear on this, that is not an overstatement. I'm not hamming this up for the interview to say that it's this great global catastrophe. It's this great global catastrophe. And what's incredible, Matt, is how, I mean, this isn't, you talked about redemptorists earlier. That was all about belief systems. This is science. This is the difference. And this isn't, by the way, kind of contested science. This is boring consensus science.
Would you be happy to be proven wrong in the end?
Absolutely. Couldn't, and this is something people often say to me in line, ah, oh, Gibbons, I hope you're wrong, and da da da. And I say back, do you know what, chum? I hope I'm wrong. There's nothing, Matt, in this world I would be happier to be wrong about than this whole climate thing and the whole ecological thing. But unfortunately, facts is facts.
John Gibbons, it's been great having the chat with you, and I look forward to 150 more editions of The Last Word of the Environment on Today FM. And that's it for today's Magnified with Matt Cooper. I hope you enjoyed it. There's loads of other interviews you can go back and listen to if you want. If you've liked this, please recommend it to a friend, and wherever it is you're listening to it, be it Apple, Spotify or on the Go Loud app. So until the next time, from me, Matt Cooper, and again with thanks to our sponsors, Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Looking to upgrade your business fleet? Choose from a wide range of vehicles local to you. Visit wvfs.ie/business.
Go Loud presents Magnified with Matt Cooper, proudly sponsored by Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Looking to upgrade your business fleet? Choose from a wide range of vehicles local to you. Visit wvfs.ie/business.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.